that. Enough of that nonsense. All right, everybody. All right, welcome back to another hot episode. Oh, yeah, another hot episode of Red Wine and Mystery Stories, the premier podcast on the internet that combines two of your favorite things, booze and an infatuation with mystery, the unknown, suspense, question mark. Anyway.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, I'm your boy toy, Patrick M. Dunn. Welcome back. Welcome back. And I'm joined here side by side virtually. Who do I have here with me today?
Jill Buck, as always.
Yeah, welcome back. Welcome back to the
recording
roundtable.
Yeah, recording from our respective conspiracy dens.
Mystery dens, whatever we call
yeah,
it.
Yeah, our mystery
week.
Dens.
Conspiracy codes.
Yeah.
mystic mud huts. I don't know. What. Adobes.
That's an interesting one.
I was trying to mix it up, but you know what? I just ran out of adjectives, so who cares?
Yeah, we'll figure it out.
Yeah, one day. One day we'll get it together. Yeah, my voice sounds a little groggy today. I'm sorry. Sorry, I'm like wildly hungover from 2 days ago.
Yeah, Patrick's still recovering from our quarantine corner. Our third episode of Quarantine Corner, actually, which was Simpsons trivia. And I kicked his ass.
Yes. You can watch that on YouTube. I didn't make it all to the end. I just disappeared. I just, like, Irish goodbye.
You disappeared, and then you came back, and then you Irish goodbyed at the end. Like, we were chatting, and you just fucking Irish goodbyed after it was all done.
Oh, did we actually finish the game?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. I wasn't...
Yeah, we finished the game.
Oh, okay.
I won.
That's right.
Like, you lost by a lot.
Oh, you know what? This is a great like rise and fall story. So watch the first two episodes of Quarantine Corner on YouTube. Just search for it. I just annihilate Jill and Steven.
I wouldn't say you annihilate. We all had fairly decent scores. Like all three of our scores were fairly close enough, like not to be like close enough to not be embarrassingly bad for the loser, but. This one, I had like 45 points. Steven had like 43, and you had 20 something.
Well,
like that was an annihilation, sir.
Yeah, I feel like it's like a trilogy of movies where I'm the villain, and I just keep outsmarting the good guys. I'm like Thanos. I'm always like I got the upper hand. I'm always one step ahead, and then I don't know. You guys band together and figure out how to thwart me.
Me and Steven snapped your ass out of existence.
By the way, my secret my secret weakness is Blue Moon Bear. Not a friend of the show, not a sponsor. So
not for you anyway.
You know what, if we ever do a Quarantine Corner 4, it's I don't know, it's we'll,
it's bound to happen.
One day. I don't know. We might not
retire. We were trying to schedule that, and that's when you Irish goodbye'd.
All right, we'll figure it out. You know what? Maybe for Quarantine Corner 4, it'll be my redemption arc. My redemption arc. So who knows?
Not if Steven and I have anything to say about it. We're going to send you a case of Blue Moon just so we can win.
You know what? I'll try it again. We'll see if that's the case. All right. As I said, this is the podcast. We talk about mysteries. While we drink. And sometimes, just a forewarn, we often delve into other subjects. Yes, we delve.
We do get sidetracked.
Digress? Is that the word I'm looking for?
Digress, yeah. We do get sidetracked quite a bit.
Yeah.
You know, first and foremost, we do find ourselves to be hilarious, so you're going to have to put up with that if you want to make it through this app.
Yeah. But if you love us, you can follow us all over the internet. We're on... All right, so we don't have the consistency between our Twitter and our Instagram because of the availability of the username. So what are we on Twitter and Instagram? Because I can never remember the street.
So Twitter, we are at Red Wine Mystery, singular. On Instagram, we are at Red Wine Mysteries, plural.
Yes.
And then on Facebook, we have a group, which is just Red Wine and Mystery Stories.
Yeah, it's a private chat group. It's like a message board. You have to just search for it and request to join it. We pretty much let everyone in. We said that we were going to like investigate people, but I think we just let everyone in, right?
If somebody goes through the trouble of requesting to join, we add you. The biggest thing is that we don't have it as a public group because then people will join just willy-nilly, and that increases the chances of spam and ridiculousness. So we just try to keep out the spam.
Yeah.
And just having that extra, like, you have to request to join pretty much takes care of the whole potential for spam.
Yeah. We don't want to be sold, like, fizzy drinks and shoes on the Red, White, and Sisters Facebook group. We just want to talk about mysteries, poster episodes, memes, and the like.
Yeah, pictures of David Duchovny with a tea set.
You may get the occasional chemtrail post. Who knows?
Yep.
Who knows? All right. Yep. And then our big thing now is we have a bunch of bonus content. So we have a Patreon page, Red, White, and Mystery Stories. And we have our side pods there. We have Red, White, and Nickname Stories. We have Red, White, and Mel Gibson Movies, which is us going through the Mel Gibson movie catalog. And
yeah, starting from the beginning and working our way through and, you know, talking about his
Jesus-like tendencies.
Yeah, his whole Jesus obsession.
Yes. Plus, we get to, you know, maybe we'll analyze what's going on in the real world with him at the time so we can kind of see his rise and fall and then his comeback because apparently he's making movies again, surprisingly.
He is?
Yeah.
God, who the fuck would hire him?
Everybody. He did the Hacksaw Ridge movie like a few years ago. He has like a Passion of the Christ 2 coming. Yes, Jesus comes back from the dead. And
oh God,
I don't know what he does.
Does he play Jesus? Because that I feel like should be his swan song.
Jim Caviezel's like re-signed up for this. Like they're bros. The two of them, they go on boats together, boats and hoes, and they just kind of chill and. I don't know, Malta, the Malta Seas. I don't know what they do. They drink, they bag broads, they get blowjobs.
Disturbing, well, but okay.
That's a call back to one of, you know, when he left his the voicemail on his, like, ex-girlfriend.
Oh, yeah.
Talking about,
yeah, like, that really, like, anti-Semitic and abusive voicemail that he left.
Yeah, he's, like, talking to this girl, and he's just like, you know what, I don't want to see your face unless you're coming over to blow me or something. We'll get to it when we get to
yeah.
it. It's been good 10 years since I've last listened to those voicemails, but...
It's true. We'll work our way up. We're going to be working through his movie catalog, and then when we hit that time frame, we are totally just going to listen to that recording and just delve into that whole hot mess.
Yeah, and then we'll talk about the time when he had that cool mullet and like everyone's mom wanted to fuck him. We'll get to that era.
Yeah, that's like the Lethal Weapon era.
Yeah, like
of the hot mullet.
Like it's like 87 to 92-ish, I think, was his like his peak, his peak, so to say. You know, maybe he starts butt in the movie. Who knows?
He showed his butt in a lot of movies. You get to see his butt in Lethal Weapon 2, I think.
Yep.
And then also in Bird on a Wire with Goldie Hawn, you see his butt a couple of times. Like, he was big on, like, showing his butt off.
Yeah.
I think he was, like, oddly proud of his butt.
We'll keep a butt scorecard. We'll keep a butt scorecard as we go.
We'll have one of those little tickers up on our Patreon. Like, how many times have we seen Mel Gibson's butt?
Well, you know what? Like, how about, like, when we go into it, we'll make a guesstimate of what we believe the number is. And then... We'll keep track as we go through, and we'll see. Like, whoever gets to the end is right, you know, gets a prize or something. It's Price is Right style. You can't go over. It's the closest without going over.
Yep.
I don't know.
Yep.
I feel like I've seen his peen in a movie. Is that true? I don't know. I feel like I've seen, like, a little winky there. I feel like I've seen, like, a peen slip in one of his movies. Is that true, or is that just, like, me misremembering?
I don't know.
Or is that Bruce Willis?
It's entirely possible. I'm pretty sure we've seen Bruce Willis, a penis slip somewhere. But I don't know about Mel Gibson.
Well, fine.
Fun fact, you do get to see, Kevin Bacon's penis in Wild Things.
Yeah. He's like getting out of the shower or something. And, I believe it was an accident. It was like the filmmaker accidentally shot it and then they kept it in.
So he was one of the like... director or producers or something for that movie. I actually heard this in an interview with him. He actually has it in his contract that he doesn't do like frontal nudity in any of his movies, but they did a bunch of different takes for that scene, and the best take was the one where you can see his junk. And so they were talking about it, and he was like, just use that one. Just use that one. So he broke his own contract, basically, because he mentioned something about how he was like a producer or something. So he was able to make that call. because he was both the actor and the like producer or whatever. And he joked about like how he had to break his own contract of no frontal.
I love it. You know, it reminds me of that that episode of The Simpsons when they had the film festival and Mr. Burns is making that movie about his life, and there's a scene of like him riding into town on like a horse, and it's just like him being like he's like being dragged off the saddle, and Mr. Burns is like, I can't believe out of like 36 shots that was the best one.
Yes.
Oh, I love it. All right.
Yep.
It's been 10 minutes. Let's get into the mystery. I think we've babbled
enough, let's
get
into the mystery. So, you know, if you want to support this hot mess, let's just one last little word. Yeah, please go onto our Patreon and you can donate to us. Donating will get you access to our side pods and some bonus content. And we're always adding different things there. We're going to try and like up our game with that as things go on. So there might be additional tiers that we add on there with other prizes and stuff like that. But for the time being, it does grant you access to our various side pods and bonus content.
Oh, yeah, baby.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So please help us fund this hot mess of a disaster that is our podcast.
Do it often and do it all the time. That's all I got to say.
Yeah.
Be our sideline ho. To quote Monica. Monica's like 2003 song or something. I think it's 2003.
Yes.
From like her after the Boy's Mind album.
Yeah, I can't remember. Right. But anyway, to get on with this podcast, what is our topic, our hot, hot topic for tonight, Patrick?
I can't believe it's taken this long to do this. This is like the mother of all mysteries. This is just, you know, this is like a super popular one. This is one anytime something comes up where someone talks about something weird or kooky or odd, they go here. This is like the first place to go to. The Bermuda Triangle, literally.
Fuck
they
yeah.
go there.
Yeah, it's referenced like so many times for so many things, and it's always like the big bad, like, oh, the Bermuda Triangle, you'll get lost, you'll get sucked in, no one will ever see you again. So we're going to talk about that bullshit.
Yeah, and for the most part, it's kind of a modern day phenomenon. It's kind of like a modern day mystery, despite, you know, Teal's going back into some time, but we'll get into it. So you ready? Are you ready?
Yeah, let's dip our toe.
All right,
let's dip our toe into this pool.
Buckle up. Take off your socks. Dip in your toes. Splash around a little bit until you get acclimated. And then you can just go all the way in because we're about to go all the way in. So our story begins
in
1492 when no longer a boy toy, Christopher Columbus sailed the ocean blue. The day was October 8th. And as he sailed through a stretch of water between the current days, Miami, Puerto Rico, and Bermuda, he logged in his journal the strange magnetic readings on his compass and the fireball that he witnessed crash into the sea. And although...
Which...
Go on.
Can I just say, like, if there was, like, a meteor or something that came crashing down, a lot of them have very interesting metallic makeups, so that could have fucked with his magnetic readings.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll get into
just putting that out there. Anyway, sorry, I just scullied that up.
So although today scientists and historians alike have agreed that the compass readings were pretty much typical for the area, and well, a fireball is just an overly dramatic way of saying meteor, so I will say it is literally the hot origin story of what is considered to be the Mecca of deadly dark forces and other unknown entities. Dun, dun, dun. Do, 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 do.
We went two different directions there.
We did.
It's okay.
It's okay. All right. So are you curious? Are you curious, Jill, over there about where the Bermuda Triangle, like the actual like origins of those words? Are you curious about it?
Always. Tell me more about it, Patrick. All Lay right. some knowledge on me here.
All right, so the words Bermuda Triangle together as two words or a sentence or a fragment, I don't know. They were first uttered in a 1964 article written by Vincent Gaddis, which appeared in Argosy, which was an American pulp magazine that ran from 1882 through 1978, which was then briefly revived in the early 90s and then rose again in the digital ages with an online revival. But who cares? Who cares about the history of Argosy? This isn't the Argosy podcast. Yeah. No.
This is not. No.
This is the Bermuda Triangle podcast. So Gaddis, our guy, our guy Gaddis, mm-hmm. he wrote about the Marine Sulphur Queen. It was a tanker that began its final voyage in February 3rd, 1963, about a year before this article was published. It was headed towards mm-hmm. Norfolk, Virginia, from Galveston, Texas, and the last known contact with the tanker was on a routine radio message that same evening, and by February 6th, it was one day overdue from its destination, launching a Coast Guard planes all the way from Florida to Virginia that scoured the area, all resulting in zero traces of the tanker. So this thing disappeared without a trace. So the search continued on for a week, abandoned on Valentine's Day, February 14th. And the only clue relating to this was 5 days later, following the 14th, in the Florida Straits, which is 14 miles southeast of Key West, when a Navy torpedo retriever discovered a life vest and a few suspicious pieces of debris, which they connected to as being from the tanker. And other than that, they were never heard from again. So,
ooh, spooky.
So, years later, looking back, despite multiple reports, and despite multiple reports that a design flaw and regular maintenance of the ship may have led to its demise, this story, perhaps by Mr. Gaddis himself, was thrown into the web of Bermuda Triangle conspiracies. So, although, we had reasonable logical explanations for why this may have disappeared, it just became something more than it should have been.
Which I feel like is just that is really just evidence of how sensationalized just crap media, a tabloid, basically tabloid news, can really have an impact on how the general populace really sees something, like, or perceives something. That whole tabloid-esque phenomena, even though there's a lot of scientific data and hey, these people, it seems like really fucked up and that's what actually happened on this vessel. Nope. The general population is going to believe this sensationalized story because it's more dramatic and more intriguing. It's more interesting than the truth.
Oh yeah. It sells newspapers.
Which I feel like we see. Yeah, we see that a lot, I think, in our, line of podcasting.
But I'm going to say, Gaddis's fun does not stop there. So 1963 was a busy year for disappearing vessels. So a few months later, he continues to write about the August 28th, 1963 disappearance of two fighter jets who launched on a classified refueling mission, which just hearing the word classified already makes it sound
spooky.
It's eye-catching, so.
Yep.
Gaddis's description was, it was a clear day at noon. The planes were 800 miles northeast of Miami and 300 miles west of Bermuda. They radioed that they were in contact with each other and not flying close together. And, that was it. The planes vanished. A total of 11 men were killed, so to say. So,
or at least disappeared.
So what makes this a little suspicious, is debris was discovered the next day floating in water about 260 miles southwest of Bermuda. And initially it was consumed that the planes collided.
Assumed
that the planes collided. Shut up. I'm going to start over.
I'm sorry. I couldn't let that one slide. I couldn't.
All right. So debris was discovered the next day floating in water about 260 miles southwest of Bermuda. Initially, it was assumed that the planes collided, but then a whole day later, more debris was discovered 160 miles from the location of the first discovery. So later reports state that the debris defined on the second crash site was actually just a mass of seaweed entangled in old driftwood and buoys. So, as you said, it's kind of that whole media sensational thing where, Gaddis is writing about how it's weird, that one plane wreckage is discovered here 160 miles later, a day later, another plane's over here what's going on? What's going on? But then, you know, you look at it from later on, saying, actually, it was just a seaweed tangled up in some old driftwood and buoys. So.
Right, but that's not going to make the big headlines, so that's kind of pushed to the back of the page. Like, nobody's going to want to read that. So it doesn't get seen by the mass populace. And that's also one of those things where it's like, okay, well, where was it, and what are the currents like? Yeah. Are these two things just like, just happened to be because of the way the currents and the wind was blowing and things like that, and that caused debris to show up in different places or what have you? The sea is an unforgiving mistress. Like, yeah. Let's be real.
Yeah, we'll get into thermal haline circulation a little bit later as it factors into a lot of the hypothetical connections.
I love the fancy words.
Yeah, but hold on. Gaddis is just going all out. He's just dropping knowledge. So going back a bit further, I think one of the more famous incidents, the one that garnered airtime on like numerous episodes of Unsolved Mysteries, it's referenced in cinema, a la Close Encounters of the Third Kind, books, just everywhere, was the disappearance of Flight 19, which was a training flight of 5 Avenger bombers that went missing on December 5th, 1945. And the story goes that there was a number of strange phenomenons occurring, plus bizarre compass readings, and all this allegedly took place on a calm day under the supervision of a super experienced pilot, Lieutenant Charles Carroll Taylor, our new boy. You're going to hear that name a lot.
Oh, yeah.
So, Intrigue Corner. Perhaps adding fuel to the fire, the official report was that the Navy said the disappearance was described to causes of reasons unknown, launching numerous theories as to what may have happened. However, can I kind of pull back a little bit? It's also said that Lieutenant Taylor's mother insisted the Navy added reasons unknown to the official report to save her son's reputation. We're going to get into it. Yeah, we'll get into it. So.
Yeah. Just to digress a little bit on this one, this is the one that reminds me of, there's this old Twilight Zone episode, like OG Twilight Zone, where it's a commercial flight, and it's like a clear day, and they're flying along, and they end up with this weird, like, headwind thing, and they're, like, going, they're, like, caught in this, like, air current. And they're going way faster than they should have any ability to go. And when they come back down, they see like dinosaurs roaming around. Yeah. They aren't getting any messages from the tower. And they're like, what the fuck is happening? We have no radio contact. And they like fly lower and they can see fucking like it. They've gone back in time. And they're like, shit, we are so screwed. So they come back up. And they try to catch the same air current, but going the opposite way to get back to like their right time. And when they come back down, they get a radio signal, but the jetliner that they're in, the people in the tower have never heard of it. And they come back down, like they come down lower, and they're going over like New York, and it's like in the early days of air flight.
Yeah, it's like the 20s.
So they don't have jets.
Yeah,
it's like the 20s or something. They have like, it's like, okay, so these people have only seen like biplanes and shit.
So they're like, good enough.
No, they go back up. They're like, we can't land here. There is no way we can land here. It's going to cause too much trouble. So the pilot goes back up and they keep trying to like, they just end the episode with that basically like, who knows if they ever made it home? They just keep trying, and supposedly the air current is over the area that everybody calls the Bermuda Triangle. I think they referenced that. So this, I feel like, must have been like an inspiration source for that episode, maybe.
Yeah, most likely. Yeah, I've definitely seen that episode. It's a good one.
It's a good one.
I always remember that they just landed in like 1922. I'm like, it's good enough. You know what?
They almost landed, and then the pilot was like, folks, we can't. we can't, there's no way for us to land here. There's not enough runway, and the consequences could be devastating for the future.
Oh, yeah.
We got to go back up.
Because they know stuff. They know about the future, and I don't know.
Yeah, and they're worried about, like, impacting, like, you know, the course of history and stuff.
Yeah, it's going to be like, why is this giant jet here in 1922? This commercial
exactly.
airliner. And I don't know, all these people seem to know stuff about what's going on. This is weird. This is odd. Yeah.
Yeah, and all this new technology we've never seen before. These people are aliens. No?
Right. So let's go back to that day. Let's go back to that fateful day. So prior to the flight, the bombers were checked. They were fueled to capacity, and because of, they were fueled to capacity because of, you know, shenanigans. You know, just in case they're going to be up for a few hours extra. Let's just throw some more fuel in there. And they checked all other controls, dials, instruments, engines. Compasses, yes, the compasses were in working order. And each plane even carries a self-inflated life raft. And each man was equipped with a life vest. Each bomber carries a crew of three, a pilot, a gunner, and a radio operator. However, I want to point out that one crew member failed to show up that day. Perhaps he got caught up in some poontang, who knows? I don't know, but I couldn't find anything about this guy. Like, I just wanted to know, like, why he got late, or if he had, just some kind of fun little anecdote about it. But no, I couldn't find anything about it. So I don't know if that's true or not.
Huh. Okay.
I feel like, you know, that'd be a guy they'd be interviewing a lot, you know? Like, oh, like, what? Find out what happened, why he was late or something, you know?
Right, exactly. Like, you're the only one that didn't get on that flight. Now we need to know what happened, or whatever, you know, like...
Yeah, I don't know, like, I want to, like, hear some, like, weird thing, like, you know, he always gets up early, but this day he didn't, or something strange happened to him on the way. He saw, like, an omen in the sky or something, but no, I couldn't find anything out about it. So.
I feel like today that would be totally a thing. Like, he would be on every fucking talk show known to man, and, like, you know, he'd be meeting with, like, psychics and shit.
Yeah, he'd be on Dr.
They'd be, like...
Dr. Phil would have him on.
Yep. Yeah. And fucking like Oprah would have him on, and like, you know, oh, we're going to have you do a past life regression or some shit like on air.
Wouldn't do that.
Whatever
shit.
Bullshit.
Are you kidding me?
Not Oprah, but like some fucking talk show host would.
Maybe like Sally Jesse Raphael might. That sounds like
I could see,
Sally Jesse shit right there. So
it does. Or Montel.
Well, Montel is more like just doing like DNA tests.
DNA tests, yeah, and like polygraphs and shit.
Polygraphs is the Steve Wilkos guy. You get them all mixed
is
up.
Is it?
You're getting them all mixed up.
Fuck. I thought Montel did polygraphs and the like DNA analysis because he did the paternal stuff.
He might. I know he's mostly known for the DNA tests. He's mostly known for the DNA tests. And
okay.
Wilkos is the polygraph guy. And then Jerry Springer is just like bitches fighting.
Yeah. Jerry Springer is just like the giant shit pot, and he's there with a big spoon just stirring it the fuck up.
I love it. Anyway, back to the show.
Back to the show, yeah.
Roughly at 2 p.m., all five bombers took off from the Fort Lauderdale Naval Air Station, and then...
Oh, I know who I'm thinking of. Sorry, it just hit me. Maury.
Oh, yeah.
No. Maury Povich.
Yeah, Maury Povich is the DNA guy. Well, who's Montel? Montel Williams, who's that?
That's something. Montel Williams, he had a talk show, too, but then he became, like, spokesperson for some, like... like get cash now thing or something, I think.
Hold on, I gotta bring him up. I'm curious. Sorry, guys.
He's bald and he's got a mustache.
He did a tabloid talk show, so I'm guessing he just had on like.
Yeah. It's Maury Povich is the DNA analysis revealed that was a lie.
All right.
No, he did polygraphs too because he was totally the polygraph shows that. That was a lie.
Hold on, I got it. Montel, his show, it was similar initially to the Jerry Springer show. It was tabloid, talk show. However, as the genre became less popular and he shift focus onto inspirational stories and less controversial subjects,
Gotcha.
However, in his prime, he often had our favorite psychic, Sylvia Brown. She was always on doing psychic readings. She would do cold readings.
He would be the one that had this guy on meeting with a psychic.
Yes. And then he kind of... Hold on.
Didn't he have some, like, weird health thing? And then he became a, like, spokesperson for something after that?
He became a spokesman for prescription assistance, a patient assistance program, Clearinghouse, that helps low-income patients apply for free or reduced-price prescription drugs. And after that, he kind of got involved in some MLM-based poker website and payday loans. Payday loans was another thing that he got.
Okay. I thought he was involved with payday loan crap. All right. So anyway.
Now he's
he would be the one.
Now he's big into CBD oil.
He would be the
oil.
One with the psychics. Of course he is.
Yeah. Multiple sclerosis. That's what he is suffering from.
That's now. Okay. Thank you. I knew he had like some major medical thing, and that caused a shift in some of the stuff that he like signed on for.
This is wild. All right.
Yeah.
Montel was hospitalized on May 30th, 2018. He had been working at a gym, and having seen the symptoms of a stroke before on the Dr. Oz show, Montel immediately knew that he had to act quickly. He went to the New York Presbyterian Hospital and became part of the stroke alert system there, and he suffered a major cerebellar hemorrhagic stroke that day. So good for him for, you know, watching that episode of Dr. Oz one day. At least somebody was watching Dr. Oz. Not a real doctor, by the way. A real doctor.
Yeah, I know. Like, that's probably the only good thing to come out of that Dr. Oz show, because Dr. Oz is a fucking joke.
Yeah. All right.
Ugh.
All right. Who cares?
Anyway.
Who cares? So
let's move away from all the dumbass people on TV claiming to be doctors and shit, wearing scrubs and blah. So.
All right.
So this plane and guy, the guy looking for Pudentang, and so he was late for his flight.
Yeah, so he missed the flight, but at 2 p.m., all five bombers took off from the Fort Lauderdale Naval Air Station. And I got, you ready for quote corner? You ready for a long-ass quote corner?
Yeah.
All right, this is what Gaddis has to say. This is what he wrote in the infamous Argosy publication, so... It was a routine patrol flight. The navigation plan for the formation was to fly due east for 160 miles, then north for 40 miles, then back southwest to the air station, completing a triangle. The relatively short flight would require about 2 hours. The first word from the patrol came to the base control tower at 3:45, but the strange message did not request the expected landed instructions. Colin Tower, this is an emergency, the patrolier said in a worried voice. We seem to be off course. We cannot see land, repeat. We cannot see land. Where is your position? The tower radioed back. We are not sure of our position, came the reply. We can't be sure where we are. We seem to be lost. Startled, the tower operators looked at one another. With ideal flight conditions, how could five planes manned by experienced crews be lost? Assume bearing west, the tower instructed. There was an unmistakable alarm in the flight leader's voice when he answered, We don't know which way is west. Everything is wrong. Strange. We can't be sure of any direction. Even the ocean doesn't look as it should be. Apparently, not only the sea looked strange, but the sun. Yes, the sun was invisible. During the next few minutes, the tower operators listened in as the pilots talked to one another. The conversation progressed from bewilderment to fear, verging on hysteria. Shortly after 4 p.m., the flight leader suddenly turned over flight command to another pilot. At 4:25 p.m., the new flight leader contacted the tower. Tower, he said, we are not certain where we are. We think we must be about 225 miles northeast of base. It looks like we are... The message ended abruptly. That was the last word from the doomed patrol.
Dun, dun, dun.
However, I want to add that Gaddis's account is definitely missing some bits of information. Other sources show that weakened radio transmissions continued on for at least another 3 hours. So, By 4:45 p.m., it was obvious to the people on the ground that Taylor was hopelessly lost. He was urged to control of the flight over to one of his students, as, you know, we kind of mentioned, but apparently he didn't. I guess he, I don't know. So I don't know, like, where this conflicting information comes from. As it grew darker, communications deteriorated. From the few words that did get through, it was apparent Taylor was still flying north and east, the wrong directions that he was, you know, asked to fly. So, an hour later, around 5:50 p.m., the Calm Gulf Sea Frontier Evaluation Center managed to get a fix on Flight 19's weakening signals. It was apparently east of New Smyrna Beach, Florida, which is a little bit northeast of Orlando. But communications were so poor that this information could not be passed to the lost planes. Like, they tried to communicate with the ship, the planes, but they just weren't getting it.
Mm-hmm.
And they still continued to receive incoming communications from Taylor around this time. And although they were weak, it was indicated that he believed he was somewhere off the Florida Keys. Cue the Beach Boys song, Off the Florida Keys. And he ignored the standard protocol for pilots lost over the Atlantic to head west toward the mainland. Instead, he directed his plans to travel in a northeasterly direction. So, you know, if you're lost, you're in the Atlantic, just go west. You'll eventually hit the mainland.
Right. Like, that would make sense. Instead, he's like, I'm just going to try and get to Britain.
Yeah. So,
the fuck?
Taylor and his crew, they headed further out to the Atlantic. The radio transmissions even starting to weaken, and by now, it was now evening. The last thing anyone heard from Flight 19 was Taylor saying, we'll have to ditch unless landfall. When the first plane drops below 10 gallons, we all go down together, as the planes use up their last of their fuel. So that was the last anyone heard from Flight 19. This was around 7:05 p.m.-ish, I believe, and now, with the missing aircraft now regarded as lost at sea, the Navy organized a search and rescue mission with two Martin Mariners flying boats taking off around 7:27 p.m. to comb the oceans. The two Martin Mariners were supposed to rendezvous with the search zone. The second one, designated Training 49, never showed up to the rendezvous site. So around that time, the crew of the nearby ship SS Gainesville observed an explosion. Yes, an explosion. Over the water, shortly after the Mariner had taken off, they headed toward the site, and there what they saw looked like oil and airplane debris floating on the surface. None of it was recovered because of the bad weather. Yes, bad weather came in. But there were there seems little doubt that this was the remains of the Mariner. The plane had a reputation as being a flying bomb, which could burst into flames from even a single spark. Speculation is that one of the 22 men on board, unaware that the unpressurized cabin contained gas fumes, may have lit a cigarette, causing the explosion. So, shit.
Well,
so
big advertising for, you know, advertisement for not smoking.
Yeah, tell that to Sterling Cooper Draper Price. But
Jesus Christ.
The reason why this is, like, wild, though, it's because even, like, this, like, weird circumstances occurred around, like, the rescue mission, so it's like, whoa.
Yeah. It sounds like, though, there were, like, bad judgment calls made by, like, pilots and things like that. It's also, you know, it's one of those things that weather played a factor, even in them being able to, you know, collect debris, things like that. Weather is always a factor, especially when you're out at sea, because it's not like you can just, like, set down for an emergency landing because of bad weather. You're fucked. You're, like, dealing with ocean or you're dealing with the sky.
Yeah.
That really creates turmoil. And, you know, there tend to be more major weather systems out over the water. That's where they, you know, really build their power. So, yeah, you can run into some major issues. Just ask the guys that, you know, crewed the ship that became the inspiration for Moby Dick. They had some major issues with weather.
So there's a phenomenon that it mostly happens at night, where pilots can become disoriented with the way they see the stars reflecting off the ocean. And they have no idea which way is up or down. This is what they think happened to JFK Jr. when he was flying. That he may, like, I guess at one point he was in heavy fog. And then when he emerged from the fog, the plane may have actually been upside down. And he just couldn't tell which way is up or down. And, you know, what he thought was flying higher, he was actually getting lower.
Right, because if the water is calm, it becomes like this perfect reflective surface, and you can't really. It's almost like whiteout conditions in a blizzard. You can't tell where the sky begins and the land ends and things like that. It's the same with water in the sky at night. You can't see a definitive horizon, so it's very easy to get disoriented and not know which direction you're traveling in, or even which direction is up in that case when you're flying, because you don't have that like sense of permanence where you're on like something stable.
Yeah, which is actually why a lot, you know, if you ever look at the flight patterns for airplanes that travel from the Cape to Martha's Vineyard and stuff, they don't fly at night. A lot of them cease
right
control on just before dark, because you know these planes don't fly as high as, you know, they don't go 30,000 feet in the air. They're much lower. They travel shorter distances, so that they don't have to go as high.
And they're much smaller aircraft too, so they don't have the same. It's not like they operate the same way. They don't have the same type of controls. And you're right, they aren't traveling. They're not as high in the sky, so it's a completely different ball game. So you are dealing with that weird, misconception possibility of what's down, what's up.
Yes, and because of these planes, you know, they left at 2, they were due back around 4 o'clock. You know, when things started going awry, it was, you know, heading towards evening for them, and now they're fucked, you know. So not only are they flying in the wrong direction, you know, northeasterly, they could have also been going down instead of up. So, you know, we really don't know what happened. It's kind of wild. So, we have that incident. We have Gaddis's article. We have Cold War paranoia. So now this began to spring forth a number of theories, starting with the area being attributed to being a hotbed of UFO activity, the home of legendary sea monsters, ancient technology with the ability to crush man-made transportation devices such as boats and planes. And now there's theories of the lost continent of Atlantis, which is said to be underwater somewhere in the area. So you have all this stuff is just coming into play. The public is weak-minded. Right. As I said, the Cold War is a brewing, so people are starting to believe anything. You know, we have a dead president. Kennedy was recently shot. People are just kind of, you know, everyone's in a panic. The whole world's in a panic. Cold War, you know, are we going to be destroyed in a nuclear war? What's going on? What's going on there? So,
right. And I got to say, you know, with all the paranoia around some of this type of stuff, like the UFO activity and the, you know, Bermuda Triangle, I'm sure that was probably like a welcome respite from the actual threat of like the Cold War, with the growing tension between Russia and the US nuclear power and bomb threats and things like that, and potential for something to drop a match into that powder keg of tension, basically, and just like end the whole fucking place. So this was probably like a welcome distraction, not only for like the people in the public, but I'm sure the government was like, thank God, get the public's mind off of what we're doing to potentially fuck everything over. Let them think about this nonsense shit that is can't be blamed on us, you know?
Yeah, because there's even theories that there is an Atlantic Undersea Test and Evaluation Center, which is allegedly located in the Bermuda Triangle. And they claim it's the underwater Area 51. So, you know, this top secret facility whose exact mission statement's not known to the general public. So, you know, let's throw all this other stuff out there to get the attention off us. These are things that are coming into play.
Yeah, and you know, you even see stuff like this come up in, like, pop culture things, like movies and things like that. There's Ghost Ship, which features, you know, a lost... A ship that, you know, it was lost in the Bermuda Triangle and whatever, and all this weird paranormal shit starts happening on it. But you also have things like Star Trek Voyager has this whole episode. It's not exactly Bermuda Triangle based, because it involves things that didn't take place in the Bermuda Triangle. But it refers to strange, unexplained disappearances from Earth. And it's called the 37s or something like that. And they find this like planet where there's all these people in like cryostasis, and they're all people that had been abducted from Earth. And, you know, some of them are some of the greatest like disappearance.
Oh yeah. Amelia Earhart's there,
you know. Yeah, Amelia Earhart's there and stuff like that. So that's kind of fueled. I know it's not exactly the Bermuda Triangle, but it's fueled by things that are, you know, similar in nature, like the unexplained disappearances that are attributed to these like supernatural phenomenon or whatever. And it does come up in these little pop culture references. Yeah, it's very interesting how that's had an impact on everything.
However, in a bizarre set of circumstances, one so-called Florida man, oh yeah, the Florida man's making an appearance. He had once claimed to solve the mystery. This so-called Florida man is a gentleman by the name of John Meyer. He read a book about the Bermuda Triangle in the early 80s. And he guessed that Taylor and his crew had probably flown over the Grand Bahama Island, but never saw it because they were engulfed in clouds. And when they flew out of the clouds, they saw a string of smaller islands that they assumed to be the Keys and flew north instead of west. And then Meyer was also convinced that one of the Avengers was somewhere 35 miles east of Cape Canaveral. A few years after his estimation, after the 1986 Challenger explosion, a submarine searching for parts discovered the remnants of an old aircraft, which they believed was an Avenger, but they weren't able to conclusively say if it was or not because they couldn't find any identifying numbers that were most likely dissolved by the seawater. So it was never actually proven if that was one of the planes or not, but it's likely that they probably found one or two. So,
right. Which, I mean, I know Florida Man gets a lot of shit because, good God, Florida Man is usually just Florida. A shit show. I mean, it's Florida. But this does actually have some interesting points in it, because if they did, you know, fly into cloud cover and get disoriented from that when they came out because they saw landmarks that they assumed to be one thing but were actually another, that could have led to going off course, and then which led to them going off course even further and just perpetuating that whole, you know, bad decision based on incorrect information, basically. So that does have some weird merit to it.
Yeah, and this was why Lieutenant Taylor's mother insisted on the Navy saying the disappearance was due to reasons unknown, is because, you know, when you're lost in the Atlantic, the popular thing to do is to fly west. And he, you know, she didn't want her son's reputation ruined as, you know, killing all these people. In the disappearance.
By making a bad decision, right. Yeah.
So the Navy just kind of buried the case, and we're like, all right, we're just going to move on with our life. You know, no one will ever think about this again. But lo and behold, then the story emerges, you know, 20 years later, it's being written about, and it just kind of sparks interest again. And it even continues on into the 80s, as I said, because now this guy is writing about it, but he may have solved it. Who knows? He wrote a book. After 30 years of investigating this, he eventually published a book in 2012. I looked it up. It cost $75 on Amazon, so, you know, I probably won't be picking this up anytime soon. But he claims to have solved. No. He claims to have solved the Bermuda Triangle. I did read some reviews. It holds 4 stars. Many of the reviews are compelling enough for me to, you know, want to know more. But I'm not shelling out $75 for this. I feel like we can get bullet points.
Yeah, neither am I. Unless we can get like some good Patreon followers and some, you know, the funding to be able to purchase a copy for the two of us to read, I don't think it's worth it.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll see. So that's kind of the two of the most popular cases, or three of the most popular cases. Over time you hear about other things. However. You ready to get into hypothetical explanations as to what is probably going on?
Of course.
All right, we already kind of mentioned this. Compass variations, it's a thing. as compasses do not have natural magnetic variations. I'm sorry, as compasses do have natural magnetic variations in relation to the magnetic poles, and there is nothing mysterious about a compass changing. It's a thing that happens. The public is just not really in tune to it. But compasses,
right? It's not something that people really talk about because it's not interesting. It's not something that is easy to sensationalize. So of course, the general public who are consuming media that is from unreliable sources are not going to get that information because it's not what they're looking for. They're looking for dramatic and like shock and awe type stuff.
Yes. And then you have the Gulf Stream, which is a major surface current driven by thermohaline circulation that originates in the Gulf of Mexico and then through the Straits of Florida into the North Atlantic. And it moves pretty quickly. That's why I said you might be able to find debris 160 miles away from where they first found debris. So, you know, that can explain some of the weird separation of plane parts and stuff. You kind of mentioned violent weather is known to occur in tropical waters, and not just hurricanes, but fast-moving, quickly forming microbursts. These tend to just spring up late in the day, late in the evening, and they just dissipate as they head towards land. So, you know, people might not know about these storms off the coast of Florida going on because, you know, satellite technology wasn't as defined as it is today.
Right.
Another interesting one is methane hydrates. Those are basically, it's basically just methane water bubbling underneath the water. And they've recreated these in labs. They've done lab experiments that have indicated that large enough methane bubbles could potentially decrease the density of water and may produce frothy water that could potentially reduce the buoyancy of ships. However,
ooh, interesting. Almost like a sinkhole, but in the water.
Yes. However, they've kind of have studied the area, the Bermuda Triangle area, and they have, you know, there's no indication that there has been a large methane hydrate occurring in the area within the last 15,000 years or even anything big enough in the world that could potentially.
Yeah, because that would, I would assume that would be a pretty big event that you could record and you'd be able to see like remnants and like measure, you know, methane levels and stuff around the area to be able to definitively say, yes, this is basically what happened.
Yes. And however, there is an area somewhere off the coast of Georgia that does have methane hydrates, but they're not, it's not a problem. It's not a problem with boats. Right. It's just, it's a problem, I think, with fishing vessels. I think the fish there are dead or something. I think that's the
right big because concern. It would affect the like oxygenation of the water, I'm sure. So it probably is like a dead zone for fishing. That actually reminds me of something that I saw on the NASA's Unexplained Files. They actually talked about this, which I gotta say, NASA Unexplained Files, they're talking about things that people have viewed as unexplained, but they're giving you the actual scientific data that explains the information. So it's very informative. It's kind of cool. It's on Hulu right now. Ooh, yeah. They had one that they talked about, like, these strange occurrences of, like, an entire village died suddenly. And just like it didn't look like anybody was trying to flee or fight against something. And one of the theories is they were villages that were like near lakes and bodies of water. And there was a theory that it was a big CO2 pocket that had like bubbled up because of like volcanic activity or something like that and basically suffocated the entire village in a very rapid amount of time because of how it bubbled up through the water. So I'm assuming that the methane thing would be similar, like as far as the fish goes and stuff like that.
Ooga, yeah. The area is also attributed to potentially being a breeding ground for rogue waves due to the convergence of multiple storm systems in the area. So rogue waves are tall, steep walls of water, which often hit unexpectedly. You know, as I said, in the Bermuda Triangle, you have storms coming together from all over, like coming from Mexico, the equator, and the further along the eastern Atlantic. You hear about it, like, hitting cruise ships sometimes. They always talk about how, like, sometimes every now and then a cruise ship gets hit by one of these waves. And, you know, it causes chaos for a little bit. It's, you know, it's not horrible. It won't really sink a ship, but I don't know. Maybe back in the day it could have done it. Who knows?
Yeah, and I mean, obviously ships are much larger now and can handle a lot more abuse. Back in the day, they might not have been able to, especially if you have like an inexperienced captain or somebody doesn't see it coming with enough warning and they don't have time to react and like get the ship in the right position to actually like handle it and come out the other side. Maybe they capsize, maybe they sink, whatever.
And then my favorite theory, my favorite hypothetical explanation is just humans being humans. Human error. It's likely cause in many of these famous incidents, although several of these incidents have been high profile, author Larry Cush wrote in his 1975 book, The Bermuda Triangle Mystery Solved, that the number of ships and aircrafts reported missing was not significantly greater than any other part of the ocean anywhere else in the world, and that many of these reports were often exaggerated and also may not have ever happened. Cush writes about a missing plane in his book that allegedly took off in 1937 from Daytona Beach, but when he started doing research on this, he could not locate any articles or news reports related to the event. It was like, this event never happened, but people talked about it as if it did happen. So you kind of are just getting urban legends just being strung out into the world. And, you know, in like the 60s and the 70s when Bermuda Triangle mania was rampant, you know, people aren't going to remember about a missing plane from 1937. It's out of the common knowledge of many people. And no one's going to go through the trouble of trying to look this up. This is not like the internet where you could just easily look up this information. You had to go to fucking libraries, go through microfiche and old newspaper prints. Just to find out.
Go to the card catalog and look up all the reference materials.
The Dewey Decimal System. Shout out to the Dewey Decimal System. And also, the wildest thing that I've done in all my research into this is that one report by the WWF, not the World Wrestling Federation, but the World Wildlife Foundation, I think is what it stands for. They published in 2013 a list of the top 10 most dangerous shipping routes in the world. And the Bermuda Triangle did not even make that list. In fact, the South China Sea itself appears to be the most deadly than any other shipping route in the world. Yet, like, hearing about it in the Western world is, like, non-existent. You, like, really have to start digging into this. You have to do some deep Google searches before you find anything about which is the most dangerous, shipping route in the world. So it's wild to me.
Yeah, I'm sure part of the reason that it's like downplayed and you don't see a lot of information about like deadly shipping routes is because the Bermuda Triangle is so sensationalized in like Western culture and stuff.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So, just a thought.
However, there's one thing I didn't reference. Which could be the culprit.
What do you think? I think I know where you're going with this, and I agree. This is something that really doesn't get enough attention when it comes to the Bermuda Triangle. Everybody's so focused on the water aspect that people tend not to look up and see the real cause of the situation.
Yeah. We talked about the plane flying through some suspicious clouds. They said it was like the sun disappeared. Maybe these pilots were breathing something in that caused them to hallucinate, maybe to see something that wasn't there. I don't know, but I'm kind of like wondering where these strange chemicals came from. That's the mystery. Like,
is the mystery.
How were these chemicals getting into the sky? Was it the Atlanteans? The Atlanteans? Is that how you call them? Try to think of
Aquaman. Sure, we'll go with that.
What do they call them in Aquaman?
I think it is Atlanteans.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So, we'll go with that.
Or even going back to that underground sea test and that undersea test and evaluation center with the secret mysteries, like, experiments they were doing.
I believe that's Sea Lab 2021.
Could be. So who knows? Maybe this is an early form of chemtrails that began happening in experimentation. Maybe some, like, post-World War II stuff started happening. We're getting ready for the next big war. We don't want to lose to the superpowers. No, America wants to, you know, go on forever. Mm-hmm. So we just kind of started working on different forms of weaponry. You know what? Guns and bombs. You know what? They might not always do the trick. Maybe we need chemicals. Maybe we need trails of chemicals.
I think you're right. And I think, you know what? This is something that we may not have time to delve into today. So we might have to just make this an episode of itself. I think we need to really delve deep into these chemtrails next time and maybe relate it to the Bermuda Triangle and really get to the bottom of the situation.
Yes. Yeah, so I'm going to give you the rest of the day off. We're going to go to our local libraries. We're going to log on. Mm-hmm. We're going to log on, and we are going to get to the bottom, finally do it, of
chemtrails.
Deuces, motherfucker.